What if you went into a relationship fearless? You could tell the truth because you weren't afraid that it would end. It probably wouldn't end if you told the truth.
You're listening to The Drew Marshall Show, Canada's most listened to spiritual talkback program.
Maybe you should write this down. You want to keep a love together? The best way is to end it now. Because when you both know it's over, suddenly the truth comes out. You can talk about your secret passion. You can talk about your restless doubt. When there's no pretending, then the truth is safe to say. Start with the ending, get it out of the way. Now there's no defending, no one has to win. Start with the ending, it's the best way to begin.
I always love that song by Dr. David Wilcox, as I like to call him. Up next on our show, Dr. Harville Hendricks. Folks, you are listening to The Drew Marshall Show. We're streaming live at drewmarshall.ca, and we are live here in Southern Ontario, way up here in Canada, on Joy 1250. This fella is known as... Fella? Just call him fella. This
call
gentleman...
Dr. Fella.
Dr. Fella is known as the Oprah Winfrey Show's marriage whisperer, Dr. Harville Hendricks. Did I say that right? Did I get that right? Harville Hendricks is a clinical pastoral counselor who is known internationally for his work with couples. He and his wife, Helen Hunt, PhD, co-created Imago Relationship Therapy and developed the concept of conscious partnership. There's so much more in this blurb, but to be honest, I've got so many questions for Dr. Hendricks. Let's go to him right now. Dr. Hendricks, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Have you ever heard of David Wilcox and that song we're playing?
Yes, I have. But that doesn't mean I know anything. I have no musical talent or skills, but I do recognize stuff occasionally.
Okay, that's good. That's all right. It's just a song that I think, the premise is interesting. Start with the ending, get it out of the way, divorce, and then you can move on to a real relationship. What do you think about that? Maybe not the best advice ever given.
I think that the problem with the advice is that you tend to move on to another relationship with somebody similar to the one you left.
That is interesting how that does happen. I've seen that happen time and time and time again with people where they divorce their spouse because they're not happy with them. They don't like this attribute or that attribute, and they marry someone else with the same attributes.
With the same attributes, yes. It's what we have learned over the years we've looked at this phenomenon is that if you don't resolve the issue with the person you're with, you'll take it to the person you go to. And then you'll wonder, is everybody in the world like the person I left? You know, is there nobody in the world that's good enough for me or doesn't have these problems? And the thing that's hardest to face is that you're the one with the problem. You're the one who's the carrier of that. You're the one who makes the selections. And you're the one who goes through the repetition. So you have to, bring all that into consciousness and then stay in a context with a person long enough that you work that issue through, and usually you have to work it through with somebody who triggers it, who really triggers it in you.
It's funny how the last thing we see is the fact that the common denominator is us.
Yes, it's us.
Okay. Yeah. Well, listen, I'm just as interested in what you've been teaching and some tips and tricks for our listeners, et cetera. But I'm far more interested in your own personal story, Dr. Hendricks.
Oh. Okay.
And the only thing I know, I scoured the internet, and if you ask Bryn Friedman, you ask her what kind of a creeper I am, I can find dirt on anybody, okay?
Yes.
But all I really found was that you got divorced in 1975, and at the time you were a professor teaching marriage therapy in Dallas.
Yes, that's correct.
It's somewhat ironic, obviously.
Yes, it was very ironic, because the day I got my divorce paper after a 16-year marriage and basically what one could call and did in those days an amicable divorce, meaning that you didn't leave yelling and screaming or fighting or, in court. We had one lawyer. I went from the divorce court with my paper when it was signed to a classroom where I was teaching graduate students a course in counseling and marriage therapy. And that was a big cognitively dissonant moment to know I was going to walk into a room to teach marriage when I had just ended mine. So, yes, it was disconcerting.
Now, did you have children from that first marriage?
Yes, I had have two children from that first marriage.
Okay, 16-year marriage. Now, you know, these days I hear people saying, well, I wouldn't call that a failure. 16 years of marriage, you know, I'd call that a good run.
Yeah.
How do you respond to that?
It was a good run, and also it was a failure because I, at the time, the paradox was at the time, even though I was a professor of marriage therapy, the marital therapies that were extant at that time were ineffective. And I was teaching it. I'd also been in couples therapy with my now ex-wife. And, you know, it was based on negotiation, problem-solving, conflict resolution, stuff like that, which basically doesn't work. You have to do something else. So, but I consider that people always ask me, well, if you knew then what you know now, would you have stayed married? And so there's a paradoxical answer. Yes, I would have, but I wouldn't have learned what I know now. Had I not gotten the divorce, because the divorce was the stimulus to go into a mode of research for about 8 years after that, because I couldn't figure out, with all of the psychological background, why. I mean, I had all kinds of psychological answers, but I knew in my gut I didn't have the real answer about why I was divorced. So I left the university after 3 years. I left because they fired me. They said because I hadn't written a book and gotten tenure, so they were giving me a 3-year terminal contract. But I decided I would not go on to academia, but go into, I was already a trained clinician, so I went into private practice and went into a research mode for about 8 years, studying only couples to see if I could find and studying them in a new way and without any preconceived notions about how to treat them and what to do. Why divorce occurs? Why do couples fight? And that was my research question. And I stayed with that for those 8 years. And Getting a Love You Want, A Guide for Couples, the book published in 1988, was the first sort of book length response to that question.
Well, let me ask you, Dr. Hendricks, I mean, why does staying married matter? I mean, I come from a tribe of... the Jesus tribe, as I like to call it. I come from a Christian background, and my wife and I were married, in that scene, and have worked in that scene, and both been full-time, ministry workers, etc. And so for us in our tribe, geez, I tell you, divorce doesn't go down real well, and it's something you hang on to tightly, and you don't even consider Plan B, and you stick it out. And I mean, and look, as far as the Jesus tribe is concerned, the way that we sort of talk about it is that as far as divorce is concerned, and as far as God is concerned, divorce is never desirable, sometimes permissible, and always forgivable.
Yeah, well, that's a good position. So the question in that is, why stay married, if I heard at the beginning?
Yeah, I mean, I understand from the Jesus tribe, in the book it says don't get divorced unless there's some fooling around stuff going on.
Yes, like an affair or something.
Yeah.
So it's a really, really good question, and it is the question, I think, that Helen and I, my wife of now 30 years, second marriage, have been addressing and writing about and teaching since then. And here's the short answer to it. And I'll start off with the negative. Leaving a marriage, I move this out of any spirituality or morality or ethics, but simply what we have learned about human nature and relationships psychologically, biologically, and so forth. That if you are in a difficult situation with a partner with whom you fell in love, that's the first criteria, that you had to have some sense of attraction. That attraction is going to go away. That's the nature of the beast. It's called an endorphin or dopamine high, and it's the blood chemistry, and it goes away after the initial stimulation and is replaced with frustration, disappointment, disillusionment, and comparable chemicals called cortisol, because now you're living with somebody that you're sort of afraid of. And it's a person that you maybe think you made a mistake marrying. If all that's going on, what we have discovered paradoxically, is that you're with the right person. You know, with the exception that if they are unavailable for conversation, if they are brain dead, or if they are dangerous, that you, they might kill you or hurt you in some way.
You've just described my wife perfectly right there. I'm sorry. I'm in so much trouble after this conversation.
Yeah, I hope she's not listening, because then you're going to have some talking to do when you get home. So the thing is that we discovered an amazing paradox, that incompatibility is the grounds for a great marriage, and that compatible people never tend not to marry, and if they do, they have boring marriages. And there's a lot of divorce that comes out of that, or just, you know, affairs and compensations and so forth. So incompatibility turns out to be the grounds for a great marriage. And so therefore, when you're into these awful places that we call the power struggle, that what we now know is that you're in the right place, but you need to deal with it in a way different from what you're doing. And that is, one, to understand that something's trying to happen here that's really important, and neither one of you are cooperating with what's trying to happen. It's pretty much an unconscious thing. And so you're blaming it on each other, but actually it's something coming up in you, and something coming up in him or her that needs to be addressed. And those, what it is that we found is that you are, one, trying to become a self, trying to be you in a relationship where the other person is not too happy with the you that you're being. We call that differentiation. And you're also trying to connect, because connection is the fundamental reality of the universe. Connection is what we are. Connection is the nature of reality. Everything is connected. And I don't mean that in a spiritual sense, but, you know, quantum physics talks about it as an actual sense. And in all ecosystems, if you look at them, there's always a connection between the rain and the water and the bricks and the trees and the birds and all of that. So connection is what we are. And that's what we also want. So when in the power struggle, you experience enough anxiety and then anger to cover that anxiety, or depression to cover that anxiety, what you lose is that experience of felt connection. And you're struggling to get the self back that you sort of surrendered so you could seduce each other in the romantic love phase, and you want that back, and you also want to be connected. So it becomes a process of becoming, on the one hand, aware of what's going on, and on the second, developing some what we would call relational technologies, relational competencies, to help you deal with this turbulence, this chaos. Because beyond this chaos is an amazing order called real love, called joy, called connection. But you have to go through the valley of the shadow of death, where you will fear evil, which is a biblical sort of process, in order to move on to this potential that becomes a possibility when you stay the course. If you're on the marriage train and things get rough and the winds come up and you get off, you don't get to the destination. You have to stay on the train. You have to keep the door locked. You have to learn how to be on this train with this person. And then when you do, you both morph or mutate or grow into different parts of yourself, and you create a relationship that you can only have in the turbulence of polar opposites and of this tension that's created by that.
Okay,
so it's a long response. So
No, that's all right. My follow-up to that, Dr. Hendricks, is stay in the canoe and paddle, right?
Yes, right.
Okay.
Right.
And you also say that incompatibility is grounds for a good marriage, right?
Yep.
Now, take both of those, put them together. Would that not then suggest that arranged marriages could still be a viable concept even within consumeristic North American culture?
The answer to that is probably not. The reason is that arranged marriages have a mainly missing ingredient, which is the mutual unconscious attraction to each other that we call romantic love. And that factor is what matches incompatibilities.
But that fades. That's gone. I wouldn't even say it fades. It disappears.
Right. It's nature's trick to bring together two incompatible people and then to drain the dopamine out of their brains so that they can see themselves in their ball reality and now know that they've got work to do.
Yeah, they look back on when they were all goo-goo in love and realize, geez, we were a couple of dopes, dopamine dopes.
Dopamine dopes. And the thing about the dopamine dopes and the romantic love is when you're in romantic love, you actually are experiencing transiently and sometimes just episodically your true nature, that what it's like to be connected. And connection is joy. And when you go through the turbulence, you get to that connection, sustain it, and then you live in joy. Now, one other thing about arranged marriages. I have, that question comes up a lot with people in arranged marriages and with people like you who ask a question about it. And I've talked to people in arranged marriages about the missing romantic love piece. And here's what they've said to me consistently, and I trust one of these persons implicitly because they had studied marriage, were a psychologist and a relational expert, said, well, here's the deal, he said, Dr. Hendricks, you either pick them or you provoke them or you project onto them. One way or the other, you're going to get them to respond to you like that parent responded to you when you were little, so that you can recreate that unfinished childhood drama so that you can finish it. And he said, so it's just going to happen. So we need the relational skills that you're teaching just as much as the people who fall in love.
Wow. Okay. I'm actually looking at my list of questions and realizing I actually don't want to ask any of those questions. I've got a whole list of new questions I want to ask. So I don't know what to do anymore. Let's go back to your story, Dr. Hendricks. You know, your second marriage is 30 years old. Your first marriage is 16 years. Kids with both marriages. Is that correct?
Kids from, well, Helen brought two, I brought two, and we made two. So we have six.
All right. So staying together for the kids. I'm sure you discuss this a lot. And in my marriage, we stayed together because of the kids. Because, well, there wasn't any abuse or we weren't you know, some kind of a toxic family. There wasn't a toxic environment. Well, at least that we could see. I'm sure that we've provided some toxicity for our children. But, you know, we did stay together for the kids. I knocked up my girlfriend and then I ended up marrying her, and we've been together for 23 years. And I... So, you know, I guess throughout those years, I've said, look, love is a choice. That's been sort of a mantra of mine. Love is a choice. Love is a choice. And for you, you chose to get out of the first marriage. Or was that your choice? Or was it mutual? You said it was amicable. What happened?
Well, it just died. And we tried to revive it with all the modalities that were available at that time, private therapy, psychotherapy, marriage therapy, and it just died, and we didn't know what to do. So, you know, we did what people did in the 70s, because there were, in fact, no good marital therapies in the 70s, including the one I was teaching. So we didn't know what to do, and nobody knew what to do, and everybody just said, well, negotiate, problem solve, conflict resolution, you know, treat each other kindly. But what was missing was no one helped us understand that what we were looking for was a vital connection, and a connection in which we maintained our sense of self in a relationship. And the thing about love is a choice, that's one of our mantras also. Love is a choice, because love does not come with biology. Love comes with a decision that to make another person's welfare unconditionally valuable to you and to stick with that, especially when it's unconditional. This is one of the pieces we debated for a long time as we looked at couples over the past 30 years. Can you have a conditional relationship, like if it doesn't go well, we'll divorce? And what we discovered was everybody who goes into a relationship with conditionality to it have more trouble and often divorce than people who go into it unconditionally. And I don't mean this making a connection because you're Christian, but simply because there are certain things in the unconscious that don't get activated if you're ambivalent. It's like the unconscious says, if you're not committed, I don't want to mess with it. But when you get committed and you say, I'm closing the door, I'm going to be here, then the unconscious says, well, now we can go to work because nobody's going to get off this train. We're going to get this work done. And you get it done. So
yeah, but hold on. You know, years and years and years and years go by, and you're just sticking with it, and there is no other choice.
No, 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 no. No, you don't do that. I mean, that's hanging in there. And I have an ambivalence about staying married for the sake of the children, because I think the best thing you can do is stay married for your own sake. And then the children benefit, because the children, when they're in a marriage which there's, you know, deadness or conflict, either way, children absorb that emotional environment. It's their model of marriage. They also internalize it without even knowing it. It's like they borrow your emotions, and then they live inside them, and they'll act them out later. The point is that you don't just hang in there. You work. You figure out what to do, and it's actually very simple. What to do. It's just that the culture doesn't know it. It's not being taught. It's been in the research journals and in therapist offices, but it's not in the public domain about how to be married, how to stay married, and why. And, you know, there are just three words that we could teach the whole culture, and if the culture did it, you'd have great marriages.
Uh-oh, I got to know what those three words are.
Well, the first one is safety. You have to make the relationship safe, and the way that you do that is you have zero negativity in all your transactions. You just decide to stop being self-indulgent and blaming everything on your partner.
Yeah, but that requires, for some people, a boatload of therapy.
Or just shut your mouth. You know, you can stop smoking without getting a patch. Just stop smoking.
You sound like Bob Newhart.
Yes. Yes, you got 5 minutes. Stop it.
Yeah, that's right.
So, but you can do it, and some people can do therapy. And to me, it's just whether you want to do it as a process or whether you just want to get it done. Helen and I had to do it in our marriage. When 10 years into our marriage, the first 10 years were very unpleasant for both of us.
Why?
Well, because we weren't practicing what we knew. We had created a marital therapy that was helping people all over the world. We weren't practicing it. So we almost got to a point of divorce, and you probably don't find this on the website, although it is in print somewhere. We decided that we would not divorce, although we had our lawyers all lined up. And we were going to give this Imago process, which we had co-created, a full chance, and we're going to give ourselves a year. And if the end of the year, if we couldn't pull it off, then we were going to divorce. And so we sat down and said, well, if we did the Imago process as we have designed it, what would be the outcome? And the outcome, you know, easy. Every couple who goes through this process all the way come out with a relationship in which they're safe. And it's made safe because they give up criticism. You know, they may occasionally slip, but there's a quick repair process. But
right.
Criticism is gone.
Okay, so the first one is safety. Sir, I'm just looking at the time, oh, my goodness. This is so unfair. This is the most unfair interview I've done in 10 years.
But
from the point of view that I've got 9,000 questions and 4 minutes left. How does that going to work?
Well, we can talk again if you want to.
So what's the second one?
So let me give you the second word. If you feel safe all the time, then you'll have a felt sense of connection. And that's what everybody wants, is a felt sense of reliable connection and warmth. If you have that and sustain that with zero negativity, then you will, the other side of connection is like a coin. The other side of connection is joy. Then you're into joy, and we think that that is normal. That's who we are. Is connected and joyful. And when you're not in that mode, you then are into anxiety. Safety is gone. And then you have to go in defenses. And then you go into blaming and all the other stuff.
Right. Yeah, the blame shift. That's a beautiful game. Okay, what about, did you grow up, Dr. Henderson, with any sort of religious beliefs? Or did you do church? Or, I mean, what's impacted you over the years?
Well, I became a minister when I was 17. Had a church. At 17, as a Baptist, you can have a church and be ordained whether you know anything or not.
Oh, that's so funny. Yes, sir?
So I did that, but then I realized when I went to college and graduate school that I grew up in the South, that my theology was pretty much a Southern regional theology that had very little to do with the New Testament. And so in graduate school in theology, I began to understand really what spirituality was, what Jesus was up to. You know, it was only one thing, love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, and soul, and your neighbors yourself. And everything else, that fulfills the law and the gospels. And so, you know, he demolished Judaism and the church and all of Catholicism and Protestantism that came after that in that one sentence, which of course is ignored by most spiritual traditions. So yes, I do have a spiritual background. Baptist who gave me birth probably wouldn't claim me right now.
No.
But I feel very, very much connected to the ethic and consciousness of Jesus and what he was about. But he was about what Buddha was about and what Hindus were about and what, you know, Islam is about when it's in its, you know, in the fundamental core thing, which is love, connection, unity, peace, and care for everybody.
Why do you think that there's no real difference between the faith community divorce stats and the secular community divorce stats?
No difference, because neither one of them have really useful relationship knowledge or technologies. And so one, that without that, they don't know what to do.
But the selflessness that Jesus taught, you know, even when it comes to agape love, unconditional love, and you talk about that, leading eventually to Eros, you know, if we hunkered down to what to the red letters that Jesus apparently spoke, you'd think that would make a big difference in keeping marriages together.
No, it doesn't. Because if you don't do something other than just hunker down, then you just hunker down. But you have to do something. And what we have is a process in Imago called dialogue. And it's a conversation that you learn to have with your partner in which there is a recognition and honoring of difference. Because difference is the only problem in the world, is there's difference. And I don't like it. So we have to get it that we're not the center of the universe, that there's a difference, and that difference then has to be discovered. It has to be, you have to become curious about it. You have to then finally accept it and adore it and become the advocate, especially in your partner. And when you do that is when you create the safety. And when you create the safety is when you experience connection, and that's when you experience the joy. So it's not like just being faithful. It's you have to have something to do. I've talked to evangelical Christians about this a lot, and they are very convinced that what is in the New Testament is correct, but it has no methodology. And that what we have discovered in Imago and in the field of relational sciences is a methodology of transforming all of this into operations that actually create emotional health, repair the childhood wounds, and help people move into their normal state of being, which is connection and joy.
Amazing stuff. You are very easy to listen to. I love your methodology, Dr. Hendricks. And let me finish with this, if you don't mind. I'm still very fascinated with your story and where you've come from, and because I think who a person is helps me decide how much I'm going to listen to them. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Sure.
Well, let me ask you, is it unfair to expect your spouse to give what they don't have to give? Do you know what I mean by that? So example, you know, a couple sits down and they say, look, you know, this is what I've decided I really need. If I'm going to just cut through the mustard here right now, I really need X, Y, or Z from you. Mm-hmm. But then you look at the spouse, or the spouse looks at themselves, and they just say, honestly, I can't give you that. You might be wired with it, or you might have a cracked love tank. As much love as I give you, it's going to just seep right out, and I can't give you as much love as you need, or as much attention, or as much coddling, or touch, or, you know, we just had Gary Chapman on the show there a half hour ago, and, you know, a five love lay. I can't do any of that stuff. So how unfair is it to expect a spouse to give you what they don't have to give?
It's totally necessary for that to happen, that is, to your spouse to give you, and it must be mutual. And the reason I say that with that, the dogmatism I'm saying it is that when we fall in love, we always fall in love with the person from whom we want something they can't give us. And that's because they're similar to the caretakers in childhood who didn't give us what we needed, which made us wind up in adulthood to be the person we are, and unconsciously marry somebody similar to the caretakers with whom we have unfinished business, namely they didn't give us certain things we needed.
Right.
But the same thing is for you. You have to say, because she's going to look at you and say, well, I don't want this. And you say, well, you know, too bad. But I used to think that was a dead-end street. I spent 2 years working on that problem. and finally got clear in working with couples about it is, and also, you know, paying attention to my dream life and what happened in the shower when the one water hit my, you know, stirred my creativity, was this, that if my partner's going to ask me for what I'm least capable of giving, but what that means is they're going to want something from me that I didn't develop in childhood because I shut it down in my family.
Right.
I don't even know I have that capacity. And I'm going to marry somebody who wants that from me, and that's the greatest gift that they can give me, is to ask for something that looks impossible because I do have the capacity. And if I respond to them, then I grow a part of myself that in childhood I became atrophied in my family. And if you do that mutually, then marriage, a committed marriage in which you call on each other and both commit to growth, grows you into new parts of yourself. You become a different person. Helen and I often walk around saying, we co-created each other. We helped each other finish becoming a self because we asked from each other things that seemed impossible when we met, which we grew into, and now we are that which we asked for.
Right.
That is, Helen wanted, you know, me to be a certain way, like express a lot more emotion. I didn't grow up expressing emotion. You don't do that on the farm. You just work,
yeah,
and plow. But now I'm aware that I grew my emotions around Helen, and now I'm a very emotional person. And the richness of life is, you know, greatly increased if you can feel things.
Let me finish by saying this, Dr. Hendricks. Honestly, I know this just sounds like a typical radio guy thing to say, but yours is the first material I've come across that I actually want to order. I actually want to go out and buy. I want to get. I want to read. I want to process. I want to walk through this with my spouse. I was a pastor for 5 years. I've taken a lot of couples through a lot of marriage therapy, Prepare Enrich, and everything else. But yours has just lit me up. Thank you.
Listen, I have an offer. Why don't you and your partner come to one of mine and Helen's workshops? We'll comp you. And you can step in. You can get the book, Getting the Love You Want. That'd be one thing. But come to a workshop on a weekend. Like at Kropala or Omega, which are two retreat centers and about 2 hours from here.
Are they anywhere near the Bahamas at all?
Don't have one near the Bahamas.
Just checking. Okay. Well, listen, folks, now you know why Oprah Winfrey has called him the marriage whisperer. And I do appreciate it very much. I know we'll be in touch, Dr. Hendricks, and I'm very sincere when I say thank you for what you've done.
I think that's one of the biggest honoring statements I've ever had. So I thank you very much for giving me that that compliment. Thank you.
We'll talk soon, I hope.
I hope so, too.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Like what you've heard? Listen again online at drewmarshall.ca.
Hey everyone, this is Drew Marshall. Look, every August we end our season by replaying some of the best interviews of the year. Our regular advertising partners love it because our listenership goes through the roof. Well, this August we're offering a special advertising deal for everyone. Imagine your commercial being played in between celebrity interviews with the likes of recording artist Sinead O'Connor, or Dr. Quinn medicine woman Jane Seymour, or soap opera star Michael Damian, or DJ from the hit TV show Full House, or co-star of The View Sherry Shepherd, or Juno Award winner Bruce Coburn. Man, we've got so many to choose from. So here's the deal. We'll offer you 6 weeks of advertising. That's 4 30-second spots per show, a total of 24 commercials, which we'll produce, and an advertisement on our website, all of which would typically go for about $1,200. But you get it for only $6.95 plus tax. That's about a 40% savings. And then, of course, don't forget to take off an additional 10% for our 10-year anniversary special. So become an August advertising partner with The Drew Marshall Show today. 6 weeks worth of commercials and your advertisement on our website for only $6.95 plus tax. Then take an additional 10% off for our 10-year anniversary special. You'd better get on this soon because this offer ends July 28th or when the limited number of spots fill up. Call 905-845-2821. That's 905-845-2821. 905-845-2821, extension 367. Or, of course, contact us at drewmarshall.ca.